every life transformed by medicine is a story. One that often begins with an investigator with a fresh idea. An idea that turns into a study and that ultimately advances patient care. Only innovation can truly help our patients live longer, healthier lives. Hello, my name is Dr. Kira O'Sullivan, and I am a breast medical oncologist at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. This is the monthly podcast of ACRU, the Cancer Research Network, whose mission is to establish the next level study for cancer research across the major disease groups. In this podcast, we want to hear the stories behind the innovative ideas and listen to the unique journeys of our researchers. Listen in as we explore the people and ideas of today's leading translational research. Welcome to the ACRU Transformative Research Podcast. My name is Dr. Kira O'Sullivan, and I'm excited to host this episode as we explore the stories and innovation of today's leading translational research. Our special guest today is Dr. Keith Knudsen, who is a colleague of mine at Mayo Clinic. Keith is currently an immunologist and professor of immunology at Mayo Clinic in Jacksonville, Florida. His research focus is on the immunology and immunotherapy of breast and ovarian cancers, both the basic immunology and clinical translation, including clinical trials. His work is aimed at preventing patients with these cancers from relapsing after receiving optimal conventional therapies. Keith, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Dr. O'Sullivan. It's great to be here.
So I'm very excited to hear more about your work in the area of vaccines. I thought we might begin by your telling us about how you started researching preventative vaccines for patients with high-risk triple-negative or HER2-positive breast cancer. That idea is so promising for patients.
That has been the primary focus of our research over the past many years. And in more recent times, we've actually branched out into treating patients with advanced metastatic disease, as well as developing a new vaccine, which we hope to get into the clinic in the next few years, aimed at preventing breast cancer altogether, the primary prevention. But where this all started was back about 15 to 17 years ago. I was working as a postdoctoral fellow up in the University of Washington, and I was investigating the development of T-cell immunity in patients that had had cancer, a variety of different kinds of cancer, but mostly lung cancer, breast cancer, ovarian cancer. And it became clear at that time that patients without any type of intervention, we're developing natural immune responses. And I became very interested in that and became very interested in the idea that, well, if the natural immune responses are occurring, perhaps they're protective. And if they're protective, we would be able to perhaps create a vaccine that can stimulate that immunity, particularly after they've had their conventional therapy, whether it's surgery or chemotherapy or something like that, to get rid of all the tumor in the hopes that we could prevent the cancer from coming back.
And how has vaccine development changed over the past 15 years, providing you with hope that we will actually be successful in immunizing the patient against cancer?
So at that time, there was many other laboratories that were interested in developing vaccines for the treatment of cancer. But where it's all started was it was a new concept. And at that time, we didn't have any newer innovative strategies that we have now, such as immune checkpoint blockade. And so there was this idea that we could use cancers to treat an established bulky malignancy. And oftentimes, the clinical trials that were being designed at that time were aimed at shrinking tumors in patients that had been through many, many rounds of chemotherapy and other types of therapeutic approaches to get rid of their cancers. And as a result of that, a lot of those trials failed in establishing any promise or any clinical efficacy of vaccines. But in parallel with that, we started to understand why that was happening. And it turns out that cancers develop immune suppression, and they prevent the activity of immune cells that get inside the tumor. And there's a variety of mechanisms that have been identified in the past few years that people have discovered. And that explained why the vaccines that we used in previous phase one and phase two clinical trials didn't demonstrate any efficacy. Therefore, there was a shift in how we understand the use of vaccines, and it really is in parallel to how we use infectious disease vaccines. We never really use vaccines to treat an established malignant infection. And similarly, we shouldn't use them to treat an established malignancy as well. And so that really brought on this idea that perhaps the best way to use the vaccines, given that there's this immune suppression, is to use them to prevent recurrence in individuals. Therefore, over the past several years, there's been a shift in using vaccines after conventional treatments, whatever those treatments are, and determining whether or not the generation of those immune responses are safe. That's obviously one of the most important things, but whether they can prevent the recurrence of tumors. And many studies have clearly demonstrated that. Now, the challenge for us in coming years is to take those into phase three clinical trials, across multiple sites in a very consistent way to demonstrate that. And that's, like with any other drug or any type of approach, a very difficult thing to do.
You are part of an increased study researching vaccines. Could you tell us about the vaccines that you've helped develop targeting triple negative breast cancer and HER2 positive disease?
Sure. We have two big studies now with the CRU. The first one was started a few years ago and hopefully should wrap up within the next 2 years. And that's in triple negative breast cancer. And so, as many of us already know, triple negative breast cancer recurs very rapidly in a sizable percent of population that are diagnosed with the disease. And so there's an opportunity to interrogate different types of vaccine strategies. And one of the approaches that we decided to test was a vaccine targeting the folate receptor alpha. So the folate receptor alpha is expressed on or overexpressed in a wide variety of tumors, and triple negative breast cancer is one of those. In fact, it seems to be the expression of folate receptor alpha seems to be very specific to triple negative breast cancer. So we felt that there was an opportunity where after conventional treatment, when the patients essentially just go home and wait to determine if they're going to relapse or not, but to boost their immune system. And so what we've done in a large phase two clinical trial of 290 patients, we have been able to accrue nearly the full amount over the past several years. And now we're going into the follow-up period where we'll be asking the specific question as to whether or not there's any clinical efficacy of the vaccine. Now, of course, in order to do that, we have to have two arms on the study. We have to have a vaccine arm, and we have to have an arm that receives a placebo. It's unfortunate, but that's the only way that we can really tell whether or not this kind of intervention works. And similarly, about 2 or 3 years ago with Dr. Chumsri, we developed a very similar approach for HER2-new positive breast cancer. So we know, just like triple negative breast cancer, that there are subsets of individuals with HER2-new positive breast cancer that relapse. And the idea is to really prevent relapse in those individuals. So we came up with a very similar strategy targeting HER2-new. And in fact, the clinical pathway is very similar to that of triple negative breast cancer. In triple negative breast cancer, we're giving the vaccine alone, but in the HER2 clinical trial, which will enroll about 240 patients, with about two-thirds of those going on to vaccine, the vaccine in this case will be administered with T-DM1, which is, of course, another drug that is useful in the adjuvant setting in patients with HER2-new positive breast cancer. But very similarly, after vaccination, we'll follow up with those patients every several months and then determine after about 2 or 3 years whether or not we had an impact on recurrence in those individuals. Very excited about these clinical trials and hope that this is the right setting in which we can demonstrate the power of these vaccines.
And I mean, I think from being in the clinical setting, enrolling patients on these studies, the concept really appeals to patients, and these studies have definitely had a lot of interest. The results are definitely eagerly awaited from our standpoint as well. In your view, why is a vaccine better than taking a pill?
Well, you have to remember to take the pill every day, which is can be a challenge for some people. Certainly would be for me to remember to take a pill, but you can get in the habit. One of the hallmarks of the immune system is the ability to develop immunologic memory. In fact, that's the foundation of a vaccine. And we think about it in terms of infectious diseases often, where how we prevent the development of an infectious disease in our bodies is to take a vaccine. And what a vaccine does is it stimulates B cells and T cells, part of our immune system, to develop that are specific for whatever it is, specific for the infectious disease or specific for the cancer. And you don't have to continue taking it except for periodically get boosters or something like that, perhaps every 6 months or 1 year, or even sometimes 2 or 3 years or even more. So you don't have to really engage a lot with the therapy that you would with a based on pills, but rather stimulate the immune system. It develops memory and can keep working even though you're not doing anything to keep stimulating it.
How close are we to developing a vaccine, not only to treat cancer, but to prevent it in the first place, in your opinion?
So 5 years ago, the second part of that question, prevent, I would have said we're many, many years off, but in fact, that's changed in recent years. So I would think that there's a number of clinical trials that are ongoing. And of course, we all know the pathway to getting a product approved through the FDA is long and arduous, and it all depends on the clinical setting you put yourself into. I mean, so in our particular case, we have to crew the patients and immunize them over a course of a couple of years, and then we have to follow them for a couple of years, and then we have to go through the steps, phase one, phase two, and phase three. So if we think about assuming that the vaccines that we have in the clinic will be successful, we're in phase two. And so at the end of 2 years, for example, we'll have to start thinking about moving if it's successful, into a phase three clinical trial. And then in phase three clinical trials, you can bring in multiple sites, of course, more than you would have in a phase one and phase two, to rapidly accrue. And so assuming everything works out fine and you accrue very rapidly over the course of the year, you're talking still another 2 or 3 years of follow-up to determine whether or not you've impacted the rate of recurrence in the triple negative breast cancer population, for example. And so I think that within probably, in my expert opinion, probably within about 4 to 6 years, we should see vaccines start to appear in the pharmacies so that we can use those for patients with not just breast and ovarian cancers where we focus, but other cancers as well. And in fact, there's one that was approved several years ago for the treatment of individuals with advanced prostate cancer. And we hope that we can continue building on what we've learned from that vaccine as well as others to get several more vaccines approved by the FDA in about 5 years. And so the challenge, of course, with a prevention vaccine is that it takes a long time for cancers to develop. That's a major challenge. And 5 or 10 years ago, it probably was unthinkable in terms of how we would prevent or how we could design vaccines for preventing the development of cancer. We've been focusing on developing a prevention vaccine for breast cancer over the past 5 years. And in fact, we built that vaccine and we're going into phase one clinical trials in the next 2 years, hopefully. And we're not quite certain as to how we would move that forward from the initial clinical trials into the more advanced clinical trials and what that would look like. But we're kind of piecing together thoughts. At first, we're going to test safety and efficacy, and we'll probably do that in patients that have previously had cancer because they could benefit from the vaccine too and would be important in terms of determining the safety and immunogenicity. But then going into advanced clinical trials, what would that look like? And that's really a critical question for us because I'm not sure that we have a clear answer, because we don't want to for example, immunize everybody like we would with an infectious disease vaccine, because number one, not everybody develops cancer at the same rate. And sometimes cancers take years and decades to develop. And so we need to think about a woman's risk, for example, in developing breast cancer, and what that risk is, and how we can measure that risk, and how we can select based on that risk a population that would be at risk of developing cancer within the next 5 years, and thinking about how to accrue enough of those individuals so that we can address the question. So we are a little bit further off in terms of a primary prevention vaccine for non-viral cancer, such as breast cancer, ovarian cancer, lung cancer, et cetera. But these studies are starting to take shape, and we'll see over the next 5 years many different strategies. In fact, for breast cancer, I know of four groups, including ours, that are starting to think about developing prevention vaccines for breast cancer, primary prevention, preventing it from happening in the first place, which is just a terrific idea. And if we can really reduce the burden of incidence, we certainly can reduce mortality associated with the disease.
Just briefly to that point, in terms of how cancer can take a long time to develop, is there an age range that you would be selecting for the administration of these vaccines, or is that something that's yet to be kind of clarified?
Certainly needs to be clarified in terms of how we can use it. Oftentimes, these vaccines target what we call tumor-associated antigens. And tumor-associated antigens aren't like infectious disease antigens. In fact, they're proteins that are normally found in the body, but typically at very low levels. And when cancers develop, oftentimes they overexpress these proteins, and that's what we target. But what we don't know is whether targeting those during reproductive years in a woman would have a detrimental effect on a fetus or something like that. And so we're challenged with trying to decide at what age to go into these individuals. And I guess it just all depends on the type of vaccine. But breast cancers typically not always occur later in life, so not early. So we may choose somewhere in the 40s or something like that in high-risk individuals that are no longer interested in having a child, because we just don't know what the vaccines or the immune response would do to a developing child.
In the era of the COVID-19 pandemic, has the societal hesitancy against vaccination in any way affected your work?
I don't think so. I think the not necessarily the issues with the acceptance of vaccine, where COVID has impacted our work is approval and being able to do things. But cancer is just a whole different thing than immunizing a child against an infectious disease. For one thing, I think we're a little bit complacent, and I know a lot of people are, about the value of vaccines in society, because these diseases haven't been around for a long time. When we think about mumps and measles and rubella and tetanus, these were all very problematic diseases 100 years ago. And it was really in the minds of the people taking the vaccines at that time, it was very important that we do something about it. And now we don't see those diseases. So there's a little bit of, I think, hesitancy in terms of taking a vaccine that you don't really know what it's for. But we don't see that with cancer. Cancer is different. Cancer is very personal, because you're either at high risk or you've already developed it. And so we don't see the problems of acceptance, I think, that we would see in an infectious disease vaccine that is being used to vaccinate against something that we just no longer see.
As it relates to the future, where do you see the field of immunotherapy in breast and ovarian cancer going over the next 5 to 10 years? What trials do you envisage that you'll be developing in the future based on the anticipated development?
The advent and clinical implementation of immune checkpoint blockade strategies, so that is with pembrolizumab and nivolumab and other great products that have come about, really has revolutionized our thoughts in terms of how we use immunotherapy, and really put us in a good position to start testing a number of different immunotherapies, before the development of those agents, it was very hard to convince people that immunotherapy would have any impact on cancer. But in melanoma and some breast cancers and other cancers, it's quite clear that stimulating the immune system can shrink and even lead to a complete cure for individuals. So there's a lot of excitement. What we envision for vaccines is being able to go into a more advanced setting in combination with some of these agents. I think that perhaps one of the reasons that the modern immune therapies that we use, like immune checkpoint blockade, don't work is because that you don't have a good enough of an immune response against your tumor in the first place. There's nothing for these agents to act on. And so we think with vaccines that we'll be able to stimulate those T cells, those B cells against those tumor antigens and really empower the new immunotherapies such as anti-PD-1, anti-PD-L1, or any of the other newer ones that are on the market for or are becoming cloak or coming close to the market, to empower those to really make them more effective for the cancers that they're being used for. So where I see it, our new clinical trials is developing novel vaccines that can be used in combination with any of these immunotherapies that are being developed. And we're particularly focused on our newer or more enhanced capabilities of understanding mutation-derived antigens in tumors. And so 10 years ago, it was very difficult to sequence a tumor and understand the mutational load and understand what mutated proteins are targeted by the immune system. But with the low cost of sequencing, the low cost of developing some of these vaccine approaches, it's now possible to develop personalized vaccines. Somebody walks in the door, they have a cancer, we can remove that cancer, we can sequence it, and we can understand what it would be targeted by the immune system in that cancer, and we can formulate that into a vaccine. So that's where we see our work going beyond secondary prevention or prevention of recurrence, is to in the actual treatment by improving the immunotherapies that are being developed and coming onto the market.
So we like to end our podcast with a few more personal questions. Firstly, can I ask you, what is one of your hobbies or pursuits outside of medicine or science?
I was up in Rochester for many, many years, and I had the opportunity to move to Florida and to further develop the Department of Immunology across the sites. And as you know, Florida has a lot of water around it. And in fact, a lot of rivers and a lot of lakes and the ocean and everything. So I've actually picked up boating, and I do a lot of work on boats and rebuilding boats and going out on boats. And so I've learned a lot about boats and how they work and how to fix them and everything. So that's been one of my hobbies. And it can be real time consuming. If you get in there and start repairing the body of a boat or something like that, it can take hours and hours. It takes away from work, so I can't do it that much, but it's really a pleasure to be outside and do something that's fun every once in a while to kind of reset your brain and so that you can get back to work and think productively about what you do for a living.
Yeah, there's something about water that is just so soothing and calming, even though I think we have more lakes in Minnesota than there are in Florida, however.
There are.
What is the most important book that has affected your thinking in recent years?
I think where I've been focusing the last year is reading. This is boring reading, so I'm not talking about novels. I'm a translational scientist, and there's so many different technologies being developed now. It's really encouraged me to go back and start reading about statistics, and those have been very influential in thinking about how to design studies and really interpret studies too. And there's lots of new statistical strategies that are being developed. And I hope to go into bioinformatics here in the near future and start to learn more about bioinformatics. But certainly learning new technologies and that are being developed with respect to biostatistics has been very helpful in terms of designing new studies so that we can really get to the heart of questions and answers much faster than we would unless if we didn't have a good sound statistical foundation for our research.
What's one thing you wish you had known when you began your career? And what advice would you give to someone wanting to pursue a career similar to yours?
So I have an interesting actual career course. I actually started out after college in business administration. In fact, I was prepared to go to the University of Washington and actually get a master's of business administration. And I started looking at science just kind of off to the side. And I wasn't very young at that time. I think I was like 30 years old or something when I decided that science was extremely interesting. And I had to go back and, of course, learn physics and chemistry and everything like that. And so I ended up going back to school and in college a little bit late in my 20s and near 30 to learn these, and then went on to get a PhD. So I had a little bit longer of a trajectory. But if you have an interest and you have something that, or if you think that interest is something that you can do and become an expert at, it's challenging to change, but certainly we all want to be the best we can be and be productive members of society and finding the right thing to do in life where you're good at it and you can enjoy it for years to come is very important. So don't be hesitant to change if you think that you need to change to improve how you integrate with society and how you make yourself happy in your life as well.
So it looks like you've moved around quite a bit during the course of your professional life, a PhD at the University of Georgia, postdoctoral fellowships in Seattle and in Canada before settling in Minnesota and then in Florida. What was your favorite thing about each region you lived in and or what do you miss the most?
So at Georgia, at that time, my PhD is actually in pharmacology, toxicology and standard physiology. And it was all geared around trying to understand how the immune system reacts to drugs and how drugs, or not immune system, but how the normal body reacts to drugs and how drugs react in the body. And I didn't have a good sense at that time that I was going to go into immunology, but I was learning all of the principles of physiology and pharmacology so that would position me well to go into a career in which I was studying the impact of medicinal interventions in people. And that's what I was interested in. And I became interested in immunology actually in my postdoctoral years. So the University of Georgia, of course, is a great college, and I had a great experience there. And they have had great football team for many, many years that was very enjoyable. I had to choose something after that. And so I chose going up to the University of British Columbia, where they had a program in immunology of tuberculosis. And so I ended up going up to the University of British Columbia. But at that time, tuberculosis wasn't too much of a problem in the US, and there wasn't a lot of research going on. And so I shifted to the immunology of cancer, which was becoming somewhat more interesting back in the late 1990s, early 2000s. And that's what brought me back to Seattle. I was originally from Seattle, where I essentially transferred to do another postdoc, but this time in cancer immunology rather than infectious disease immunology. And that's where I stuck. So after that postdoctoral fellowship at the University of Washington, I was delighted when Mayo offered me a job. They were very much interested in this area. And in fact, they had a cancer immunology and immunotherapy program within the cancer center that had already been established. And so I was a natural fit for one of the positions. And I've been at Mayo Clinic ever since. And I've enjoyed many regions around the country. Florida is certainly a favorite of mine. Minnesota is a great place to be too. It's a little cold after you've lived in Florida for a few years, but I had great experience in all of the places, and really they've all guided me in terms of where I ended up, where I am today.
And finally, if you could step into my shoes as the interviewer, what would you have asked yourself today that I didn't?
Well, one of the things that people usually ask me, so I've got an unusual career course for a PhD scientist. Oftentimes PhD scientists are, you know, in the laboratory all the time. and not conducting clinical trials. So just to go on to the answer, I became very interested in really the clinical application and translational components of cancer immunology and immunotherapy after I had some personal family members that had been diagnosed with cancer. As they get older, as they got older, they developed a breast cancer, for example, in one of my family members. And understanding the power of the immune system and really understanding how we could potentially use the immune system to fight cancer. And at that time, more organization of clinical trials was coming about. And I got into a laboratory that was actually doing clinical trials. And so I learned a lot from those clinical trials and how to set up and develop translational studies and clinical intervention studies. And so that's what usually people ask me is how a PhD scientist would go into clinical studies. And I was open-minded about where my career would go at that time and felt that it was a pathway that I could successfully do. And so as a result of that, since I've been at Mayo, I've had 4 or 5 investigational new drug applications that I've developed through the system here with some of the vaccines that we've made. And it really has been just a very rewarding component of my career to be able to touch and potentially impact the lives of individuals that are afflicted with cancer.
That is all for today, but thank you, Dr. Knudsen, for this wonderfully insightful interview. It was a pleasure.
Thank you. It was great to be here.
And thanks to you, our listeners.